It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Welcome back to the MLB.com Ballpark Dimension Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello, writer and analyst at MLB.com, joined by Matt Myers, MLB.com National Content Editor. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Cubs beat writer Jordan Bastian to discuss what's going on in Chicago. But Matt, first, before we get into everything, we are about to make what I think might be one of the gravest mistakes that a non-live recorded show can make, which is to talk about the trade deadline on Wednesday, July 28th at about 3 o'clock Eastern, and knowing that trades have been happening and will continue to be happening and may actually happen while we're talking here. And yet we're going to do our best to record and get this out as quickly as possible. Did you realize there was a trade like 45 minutes ago? The Marlins and the A's made a trade. I love this trade. It's cool. It's a one-for-one trade. The Marlins traded outfielder Starling Marte to Oakland. They got back Jesus Luzardo, who has been, in the past, a highly regarded pitching prospect, but has struggled a lot this year. And a one-for-one trade like that with guys you know, it's not like faraway prospects or random veteran relievers. It's just a fun trade that I enjoy, regardless of how you feel about either side, is the way I would put it.
Literally yesterday, Mike and I were on Slack chatting about baseball trades, as we do from time to time, or daily this time of year. And I forgot exactly how it came up, but what came up was the Edgar Renteria for Andy Marte trade, when Andy Marte, who tragically actually passed away a couple years ago, was still a big prospect at the time. I think it was 2005. And I literally wrote to Mike, you know, trades like this don't really happen anymore. And today, sure enough, it's almost like our Slack was bugged, because we get a trade, maybe not exactly like that, but pretty similar, and we don't really, it's not exactly a challenge trade, but it's as close to a challenge trade as we get these days.
Is this a Marlins thing? Because what did the Marlins do last year, right? Gallen, or 2 years ago, I can't remember. Gallen for Jazz Chisholm is sort of in that same vein.
They do have a new GM now with Kim Ng, so not exactly, but anyway.
Well, that's true. That's true. You know what is funny to me? So Marte has had a really good season, right, for Miami. And he's going to be really interesting with an Oakland outfield that hasn't been very good. Do you think it's possible to say, so 1 year ago, not exactly a year ago, because last year's trade deadline was in August, but 1 year ago, he was traded by Arizona to Miami, and they got back Caleb Smith and two minor leaguers who haven't really been highly rated. Did the Marlins do better for half a year than they had to give up for a year and a half of a good player? Because it feels that way.
I guess it really depends on what you think of Luzardo now, right? Because if, you know, I've seen a lot of baseball Twitter reacting to this, of like, oh my God, what a steal for the Marlins, what a deal. And to be fair, I think they basically were going to lose Marte at the end of this season for nothing. I don't know if they can offer him. I guess they probably could offer him a qualifying offer. I don't think he's had one before.
He's been traded around. He's never been a free agent.
Yeah, but so I guess they could have offered a qualifying offer, but like Luzardo, a year ago or a year and a half ago, was one of the more highly regarded young pitchers in the game, but he's been pretty bad this year and had real trouble throwing strikes. And the fact that the A's would be willing to trade him for a rental tells you that they're kind of like, this isn't really going to work for us. It'll work for you with this organization. You know, the perception might be outweighing what the reality is with Luzardo. But I think that, like, if you're the Marlins, you make this trade, but like, I'm not sure, like, I think this is probably a reasonable trade for the A's too. Like, they're trying to win their division. They've got a chance to, and they've got to, you know, this is like I like it as a win now move.
We've said a couple of times that the A's always seem to go after like a big name guy in the final months of his contract, right? And this is exactly what they've done. They also got Andrew Chafin, a reliever from the Cubs. Yeah, the Luzardo thing's interesting. Like, he's been a highly regarded prospect. It's kind of cool. He's from the Southern Florida area, so he's going home here a little bit. He only just turns 24 next month or in September. But yeah, this year has been rough. Like, he had a 6.87 ERA for the A's, and he broke his hand in frustration playing video games. And he's been back in AAA, where he's been
really not very good there. It's on Las Vegas, so that's hard. Every Marlin fan seems to think that their pitching staff will be able to fix him, and maybe that's true. And if they do, imagine what they have. Like Trevor Rogers is really good, and Pablo Lopez, and Sixto Sanchez when he's healthy, and Max Meyer, and Sandy Alcantara, and you know Edward Cabrera. They've got a ton of pitching. I was surprised they traded a hitter for a pitcher because they have pitching and they seem to need hitting. Maybe this is not their last deal. All right, before we move on, Matt and I are each going to kind of come up with the guys we would like to see traded. Again, it's about 3 o'clock Eastern on Wednesday, so hopefully none of these guys actually get traded in the next couple hours. And, you know, Matt, you kind of, I know we weren't really claiming anybody, but since you wrote down the one I liked the best, I'm just going to give it to you. Tell me, I mean, I already know because I agree with you. Chris Bryant to the Giants makes just so much sense, right?
It makes a ton of sense. Evan Longoria is still hurt. Bryant could play third. He can also fill in the outfield, so the versatility is there. Last night, our own JP Morosi reported that the Cubs and Giants were talking and that the catching prospect Joey Bart's name was coming up. Now, I don't think that the Giants would trade Joey Bart straight up for 2 months of Chris Bryant. But maybe if Craig Kimbrel were in the deal too, who has a reasonable club option for next year, Kimbrel and Chris Bryant for one of the better catching prospects in the game, that gets interesting. And that could, you know, the Giants could also really use some bullpen help as well. Like that's maybe in some ways that's the other issue that you kind of like the, in some ways that might be the most notable weakness on their team is that the bullpen doesn't really have that like lights out guy, you know? So like, when you think about that, like that would be like a fun, bold, exciting trade that I would love to see.
Love it. Longoria's hurt. Belt is hurt. Left field hasn't been that good for the Giants this year. Like he is a perfect fit for a team that has like wildly overperformed any expectations. Like I wrote about this a couple of days ago. I have Zips projections dating back to 2005, and they are the second largest overperforming team this year. Because like we've been saying for months, there's a lot to like there. And nobody thought they could overcome the Dodgers and the Padres, and maybe they won't. Let's talk about Max Scherzer for a second. You had kind of written down here that you want him to go to the Padres. I'm saying the Dodgers, and that is because he has the full control to go wherever he wants to. And I think if there's anything Max Scherzer wants to do, it's to pitch in the playoffs. Not that the Padres can't get there, but they are in third place. And I think that of the three teams, they are maybe the most likely to miss October entirely. So I'm going to say Scherzer to the Dodgers because they desperately need a starting pitcher. And how much fun would it be to have him and Kershaw once he's healthy in the same rotation?
Yeah, no, that's fair. And as you point out, he can essentially pick his destination. And supposedly he has said he prefers the West Coast, but you're right. He could say, you know what, the Padres, I'm not sure I want to go to a team where the most likely scenario is that I pitch in a wild card game. I do think the Padres, we've seen them, you know, GM AJ Preller be bold before. I could see them giving up something, sort of real for Scherzer as a rental. That seems to be their kind of MO. And they actually have some of their like top prospects are kind of losing their luster, but still might be enough for, you know, to swing that kind of deal. Like for example, Baseball America just revealed their midseason top 100 prospect update, and they had Mackenzie Gore dropping 50 spots in their ranking. So at this point you wonder like, would they offer Mackenzie Gore for Scherzer as a rental? And like, I think the Nationals would do that. Now the question is whether or not Scherzer would veto his no trade clause to make that deal happen.
Well, hold that thought because we're definitely going to get into Eric Hosmer trade rumors in a little bit. Since you mentioned Kimbrel above, I was thinking Kimbrel to the Blue Jays would be a lot of fun, not just because they need him this year, but because he's not a rental. He has a reasonable because he's been so good, $16 million club option for next year. And it's not like that Blue Jays lineup is going to stop being great. You know, everybody's young for the most part, except Simeon's a free agent, so he'd be fun next year. Here's the one I want, and I don't even mean this necessarily in that I think this is going to happen. It's just sort of like the structure of a trade I feel like needs to happen. Anthony Rizzo to the Mariners. And here's why. It's sort of the fit, right? Because they're now only a game out and a game out of the wild card anyway. And, you know, Ty France has been pretty good at first base, but he can DH or play second or third. Like, you will make room for Anthony Rizzo. In a little bit, we're going to get into Mariners talk. And my God, they need to do something big very fast because everybody is very angry. So that's my Rizzo destination. Where are you sending Rizzo?
I want Rizzo to go back to the Red Sox where his career began. What a great narrative that would be. I think a lot of people don't even realize he was drafted by the Red Sox and then traded to the Padres in the Adrian Gonzalez trade before the Padres traded him to the Cubs. Earlier this week on MLB.com, all of our beat reporters did a story where they each gave one kind of recommendation of what they think the club that they cover should do at the trade deadline. Not necessarily what they will do, but hey, if I were running the team, here's what I think they should do. And our own Ian Brown suggested the Red Sox should go out and trade for Anthony Rizzo. He suggested both Michael Chavis or Bobby Dalbec as players that would be worth offering in a Rizzo trade. The Red Sox could use a first baseman. They could use a left-handed bat. It's a cool fit. It would be a great, great story.
Well, by the way, whenever we tape these shows, I always turn off all like my video feeds and anything else that's going on my computer, just because I don't want to have, you know, any bandwidth eaten up. And so I'm not watching any of the afternoon games, but there is a tweet I need to pass along from our twins.com beat writer, Do Young Park. And I quote, "The Twins were down 10-0 when they came to bat this inning. The tying run is at the plate." So there's a lot happening in that game. And I wish I was watching it. Okay, before we move on, you want to do some New York trades here. You think the Mets are going to get Jose Berrios? I'm not so sure about that.
Well, no, I'm not sure they will, but I'm saying I think it's a trade that makes a lot of sense. The question is what you think of the Twins. It's actually, you could have really nicely segued there, Mike, with the Twins talk, with the Twins reference, to go right into this.
Let's say that I did.
You know, there's a reason to believe. I totally buy the argument of people saying, well, the Twins just had a lot of things go wrong this year. They should try and run it back next year. They could still be a very good team and compete with for the AL Central. I'm not so sure. I think that the White Sox have, you know, especially since basically their whole core is going to be back and is still pretty young, are cut above them right now, especially since you just can't count on Byron Buxton being healthy. And he just hasn't proven in his career that he can do that and you know, be like a seven war player, which he was kind of on pace to do this year and has been on pace to do at other points in his career when he got hurt. So obviously the Mets need a starting pitcher. They have a lot of really good infield prospects. Of course, they also have Francisco Lindor. So one of those prospects, Ronnie Mauricio, who is a shortstop and I guess theoretically could move to another position, but I would think could be the centerpiece of a trade for Jose Berrios. He's under team control for another season after this one. It feels like it could be a match. But again, that's definitely coming more from like a Mets perspective of what they need. And the Twins maybe have a little bit of a different self-assessment than that. But I certainly think that if the Mets wanted to do something bold, Mauricio's out there because Francisco Lindor is literally signed for 10 more years. So the most value he has is as a shortstop, especially since the Mets have a couple of really good third base prospects, and that's probably the most natural place for Mauricio to move, considering he's really tall and kind of wiry, probably doesn't really profile as a second baseman. So that's one that I would like to see.
We will take a quick break on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast, and we'll be right back with our three batter minute.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We are back on the Ballpark Dimensions podcast, Mike and Matt. And I got to say, Matt, on July 28th, because we're doing the podcast, I did not expect one of our primary topics would be about the Seattle Mariners. And yet, it feels unavoidable. Mariners are, at the moment, 55-47. They're playing the Astros again this afternoon, but at the moment they're 7 games out in the West, but only 1 game out behind Oakland for the second wild card spot. And if you look at the FanGraphs playoff odds, you will find they are a mere 6%. Why is that? You're only 1 game out of the wild card spot. I know that's a confusing thing. It's because they have been outscored by 51 runs. Okay. The Rockies have been outscored by 53 runs, the Tigers 57. You don't consider those teams to be playoff teams. That doesn't mean that the wins they have don't count. They absolutely do. It just means that the projections don't see them as being that good of a team. Now, the fact that they have outperformed by this much is largely due to their bullpen and their clutch hitting. And I don't know, Matt, Is it, if you have a team that is outperformed by this much, largely due to the bullpen, do you think there might be somebody who gets upset when you trade your best reliever to your top division rival in the same ballpark after an incredible come from behind win, like hours later? I don't know. I couldn't imagine that players might be upset about that.
That's the issue with this trade. Like, and this is the, you know, with a lot of trades, right? In a vacuum, the trading Kendall Graveman and I guess it was Kendall Graveman and the recently designated for assignment Rafael Montero to the Astros for Joe Smith and Abraham Toro. Like, okay, it's a totally reasonable trade. But in the moment when you haven't made the playoffs in 20 years and you have this kind of have this mojo, whether or not it's like, you know, I don't really believe that this kind of clutch hitting and record in one run games is sustainable from year to year. Like, I don't think you should bet on this, whatever's going on for the Mariners right now. You don't want to plan around this being a thing that's going to continue in 2022. That said, like, there is something working for the team right now and the fans are actually engaged. They actually have a great fan base, despite the fact they haven't been to the playoffs in literally 20 years, 2001, longest drought in the game. So it's just kind of, you know, you kind of lose the fan base is kind of like, well, why do I care? You know, like why do I care? And the players, you know, as was written in the, I guess it was the Seattle Times, the players went, you know, kind of went ballistic after the trade. So it's just the optics of it are just awful. Now it probably won't matter in the long run. It kind of will depend how the team does. And, you know, but it just feels kind of icky. I guess that's what I'll say.
Yeah. Here's the quote, one of the many quotes in Ryan Divish's piece in the Seattle Times. An hour ago, it was great, said one player. Probably better than it's ever been. And now it's the worst. And that's a tough thing to come back from. Jerry Dipoto, the general manager, when asked about the trade, said, it probably doesn't make sense as a standalone, but it's part of a context that I believe is going to be an ongoing story over the next couple of days. And that is a quote that I think will be on his Seattle tombstone if he does not do something huge. Like, you have put yourself on the spot. You can't just go out and get... They traded for Tyler Anderson after the Phillies were unable to. Fine. He's fine, right? He's a guy. He's a league average-ish starter, which is value. That is not the guy that's going to have the locker room, you know, come back around to trading away your best reliever. And if you didn't see what happened the night before, they went down 6-0 to the Astros in the first inning. They pulled within one run down 8-7 in the bottom of the eighth. They went single and then two outs. So now it's two outs, man on second. You're down by one again after being down 6 runs in the first. And then walk, grand slam. Like, one of the coolest moments of the season. And then again, the next day, literally the next day, they make this trade. And there are baseball reasons to make this trade, you know, because Graveman has been really good, but he's got very little track record and he's not like a long-term difference maker. He has allowed 3 earned runs in 33 innings. He's good. He's not that good. And Abraham Toro has long been like a minor league stat nerd hero because, I mean, listen, in parts of 2 seasons at AAA, only like 200 plate appearances. Sure, he's got a 497 on base. He's shown almost nothing in the major leagues in 309 career plate appearances. That's not to say he can't or won't. He just hasn't done much. And I get it. Do you want to trade a veteran reliever with that much track record for an interesting 24-year-old infielder you have for another 4 or so years? Like, I get it to a certain extent, but is Toro enough to do something that will infuriate the good feelings around your team, even if, like myself, Dipoto doesn't actually think the team is that good, right? Like, that's what it is. This is the kind of trade that, even if it's defensible, it just annoys everybody. And he's got about 48 hours or so to fix it and do something huge like Anthony Rizzo.
I actually think the trade that's been out there that's kind of been rumored as a target for the Mariners, and I'm not even sure this guy is even that much of a difference maker, but I think might satisfy the masses a little bit, is Whit Merrifield with the Royals. Now, it's unclear whether the Royals would actually trade him, but he is 32 years old. He's under contract for 2 more years. He's due $2.75 million next year because he has a backloaded contract, and then a $6.5 million club option for 2023. He's kind of a proven veteran, and he's around for a couple of years, so at least you could sell it to the fan base of like, hey, not only did, you know, we traded for a guy, but he's going to be around. He's going to be part of this thing we're trying to build when Julio Rodriguez gets here, and when hopefully, you know, Jared Kelnick kind of gets his career on track, and we'll have some veterans around here to really, you know, put us over the top and take that next step next year. and in 2023. The other name that's out there that would be really wild is Trey Turner. I can't see that happening, but stranger things have happened.
Can I tell you another name that's out there for the Royals? We are definitely talking about Eric Hosmer trade rumors. That's our second topic here. I don't think Eric Hosmer is actually getting traded, but whenever a trade rumor comes up that says they might be willing to move him, we're definitely talking about it. We actually didn't really get around to talking to the Adam Frazier trade that happened last week. And as far as today's game goes, Hosmer's on the bench. Jake Cronenworth is starting at first base, and Adam Frazier is playing second base. And there's all sorts of rumors that, well, maybe they got Frazier and Cronenworth can play first base and they don't necessarily need Hosmer anymore. I'm quoting here from the San Diego Union Tribune, and this is literally just a quote. I don't think this will actually happen. And yet, the rumor that appears to have the most traction, a deal that would send Hosmer, outfield prospect Robert Hassel III, and cash to the Rangers for at least Joey Gallo. Oh my God, how much fun would that be? Anyway, this is the fourth year Eric Hosmer has been with the Padres, and he has not really been that useful. He has a Padres career, 101 OPS plus. He's been exactly league average. All of the defensive metrics don't like him very much. His wins above replacement per Fangraphs as a Padre, 0.0, which is no way to go through a baseball life. He signed for 8 years and $144 million before 2018, but a lot of it's backloaded. So, you know, for the last three seasons, for 2023, 4, and 5, he's actually only owed $13 million apiece. Like the contract gets lighter. Of course, the average annual value sticks with everything. So it's still $18 million apiece. If he stays with the Padres through the end of next year, he will have 10 and 5 rights, like Scherzer does, which means he has full control over where he gets traded. Right now, as per Ken Rosenthal, he has a limited 10 team no trade clause. The teams he can block are apparently Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, Oakland, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Seattle, St. Louis, Toronto. Kansas City's not on that list. They should trade for Eric Hosmer. Because not that there's any real good reason for anybody to, but because I personally would think it would be funny. Kevin Acey of the San Diego Union Tribune said, "It looks like if Hosmer goes, so does one of the Padres' top four prospects." Now that is generally Hassel, Mackenzie Gore, CJ Abrams, and Luis Camposano. Although, as you noted earlier, Matt, Gore's prospect star has dropped precipitously. So I'm not actually sure if he's still one of those four guys. Wouldn't it be fun for someone to just do, like, I know I always go back to the Rockies, right? Some team should just trade for him and say, great, play for us and we'll get a top prospect. Like that is a great way to get a top prospect that you could not otherwise access. No one's going to do this, because Hosmer's not that good. But tell me someone's going to do it.
I think this could happen because I think the Padres are motivated to do this right now. And, you know, he has 20 teams he can get traded to without his consent. So I could really see this happening. I mean, when the Adam Frazier trade went down, I guess it happened on Sunday, the first thing I thought of was like, this is a weird roster fit. This is another left-handed hitter who plays on the right side of the infield. And you make this trade because you think he's making your team better, right? And you already have Jake Cronenworth, who's been good, made the All-Star team. So then who's the odd man out? It's obviously Eric Hosmer. This is actually why a couple months ago in this podcast, I said the Padres should really be going after a right-handed hitting first base type. I think I mentioned CJ Cron or Jesus Aguilar, because I was like, this would be a good roster fit, or you know, like someone that could kind of, if you're prepared to kind of cut Hosmer's playing time down a little bit, then those guys make sense. Now the roster fit is really awkward. So yeah, the Royals would be fun. I think this could be the seeds of a Max Scherzer trade. If you say, well, send Hosmer and one of our top prospects for Scherzer, you got to, you know, that kind of offsets the money. We get Scherzer, you get a top prospect. I think there could be a fit there. I like some potential creative trade scenarios happening here. And I think the Padres are exactly the kind of team that will figure out a way to make this work.
I am extremely down for this getting weird. I think that would be so much fun. All right, our third item here is it's Joey Votto season. No, Joey Votto is not actually going to get traded anywhere, but he's been fantastic. He is just a couple of weeks away from turning 38 years old. He has hit a home run in 4 straight games, 5 home runs over those 4 games. And it's pretty fun if you split his season in half. He broke his thumb when he got hit by a pitch on May 5th. So before that, he actually was not having a very good season. 305 on base and a 720 OPS. Since then, since he came back from the injury on June 8th, he has crushed the ball, a 592 slugging percentage, a 998 OPS. Since he came back, there's only 14 players who have an OPS of 998 or higher. I'm not going to read them all off to you, but know that there are superstars in there. Otani, Vlad Jr., Tatis, Harper, Soto, Machado, and Joey Votto in there. And what I get a big kick out of is that if you look at his numbers, he has a career worst strikeout percentage. He's striking out 24% of the time, which is more than he ever has. He's paired that with a wildly career best 50% hard hit rate. Last year, he had a 35% hard hit rate. The year before, 38. And this isn't an accident. Like, he has very specifically said, I'm trying to change my swing for more power. Like, at a younger age, maybe I could do both, like make great contact and hit for power. At this age, that's a lot harder to do. So I'm going to sacrifice some contact for some power. And he's been phenomenal. And I get it, he's not getting traded. That's not what we're talking about here. Just as a fan of Joey Votto, future Hall of Famer Joey Votto, the fact that he's still performing this well, it makes me deeply happy on a team I otherwise don't care that much about. But I love Joey Votto. It is good for baseball when Joey Votto is good.
Yeah, he's an awesome player. I agree with you. Future Hall of Famer. I think there's a good chance we will both get a chance to vote for him one day.
Yeah.
That will be cool to do. And then he's also just a great personality. You know, even just like today, I saw there was a video. He was in Chicago and he spotted one like 6-year-old kid in Chicago with a red hat and shirt on. And he like pointed to him and said, come on down to the field, brought him down to like right to the front row and handed him a ball. I mean, that's how you make fans for life. And Joey Votto does stuff like this all the time. He's awesome. And the Reds, finally, it took forever, but they finally decided like, hey, you know what? We can improve our bullpen. That's allowed. I don't know why they felt they didn't have to wait until the trade deadline to do it. But they've made it in the last couple of days. They've added, I guess, or all today, they've added three relievers that will, I think, maybe are now like three of their four best relievers.
Yeah, they got Michael Givens from Colorado. They got Justin Wilson and Luis Sessa from the Yankees. That one's entertaining to me because back when the Yankees originally had Justin Wilson back in 2015, which they had traded Francisco Cervelli from him, he had one good year with the Yankees, and then he was traded to Detroit in 2015 for Luis Sessa and Chad Green, which is very funny to me. Wilson's been really terrible, but Luis Sessa is very interesting, and all the Yankee fans are like, we're trading away relievers for a player to be named later. What are we doing here? That's another story entirely. The Reds are 7 games out behind Milwaukee, and they are 6 games behind San Diego and also the Mets, but in the wild card, it's cool to see them adding, and I don't think they're doing anything huge here. Do they have a shot? Like, I'm not convinced they actually do.
No, I don't. I think it's at this point that they had games against Milwaukee where they had a chance to make up ground, and they didn't. I think they lost ground. So, unfortunately, I don't think so. I think they should have. I mean, it's obviously it takes two to tango, right? So, you know, I could say, oh, they should have made trades 6 weeks ago, but maybe there weren't trade partners then for relievers. So then maybe they had to wait. But in reality, they went into the season with a bullpen that was questionable to begin with. So it's not surprising that here they are 2 days before the trade deadline, you know, feverishly trying to add relievers to improve their team. I think it's probably going to be, as someone who's been, you know, driving the Reds bandwagon and really liked their roster more than most going into the season, it's a little bit of a bummer because I think the window was there. But I think at this point, 7 games behind Milwaukee is going to be pretty tough to make up.
We will take a quick break and we will be back with Jordan Bash to tell us everything about the Cubs.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and 3-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are back with Jordan Bashton, our friend and colleague, who is the MLB.com Cubs beat reporter. Jordan, thanks for joining us. A very interesting time in Cubs world right now. And before we get to the trade stuff, I kind of wanted to just like big picture the Cubs with you, because at least from my perspective, coming into the season from 1,500 miles away, Cubs fans were maybe a little disillusioned by the unpopular Yu Darvish trade. And then as the season went on, it's been kind of weird. Like, they weren't good in April or June or July, but they were really good in May, and they were in kind of, you know, in first place for a while, and just How has this season to date met with your expectations coming
in? Yeah, it has been interesting because I think we saw the best case version of the team in May, and we've also seen the rock bottom versions of this team. And, you know, it was funny, you know, you do the prediction stuff ahead of the season or people ask how many wins or whatever. And I always sort of landed on, I know a lot of writers will do this where they say, hey, like there's a really wide gap between what this team could be and what it might not be. But you really felt that with this team going in, and it's sort of played out that way, kind of in these really high peaks and really low valleys, and sort of landing on being right around a 500 team, which is kind of where we all thought they were going into the season. They are who we thought they were, so to speak. I think when they made that Darvish trade, so much of it was budget based at the time, with a lot of the unknowns about this season and where the payroll flexibility was going to be at. Obviously things loosened up in that regard, and you saw that wave of short-term signings, whether it was Jack Peterson or Arrieta, Mariznick. You know, they had this wave of, okay, maybe we can spend a little more, as they were trying to forecast out the pandemic after effect budget. But I think in the end, you sort of are arriving to where I kind of thought this team was going to be at the end of this season, which was sort of a second, third place team, right around maybe 500, maybe a little above 500 if things went really well. In a weak division, maybe the Cubs thought they could contend for that division crown. But, you know, the cruel nature of baseball, after they throw a no-hitter, they lose 11 in a row, and it directly coincided with the Brewers just getting extremely hot, and it just immediately separated the pack. And when that deadline's looming and you've got a dozen plus players heading for free agency potentially, it just created this situation where the writing that's been on the wall for the last several years is now very much highlighted. And as Jed Hoyer said earlier in July, life comes at you fast. And that's kind of what happened here. And I think now Cubs fans, players, those of us who have followed this team for a few years or many years for some of the writers in that press box, we've all been writing about building to this moment. And this moment's here.
Do you think there's regrets in the front office at this point about the Darvish trade, just in the sense that, you know, we've been talking for maybe 2 months now about how weak the July 30th starting pitching market was going to be? And that's really played out. Like, Max Scherzer is very good, but he's got control over where he's going to go. And otherwise, you're like, oh, do I trust Kyle Gibson? Is Michael Pineda going to turn my season around? I don't know. If you had a Yu Darvish to trade, that guy would be super valuable right now. Like, do you think going back, they wish, oh, why did we do that at the time?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that for much of this season, the glaring needs for the Cubs were an ace pitcher and a reliable backup catcher. And they got rid of Yu Darvish.
Where could you find those?
Victor Caratini. And, you know, I will say it's going to take time to see, as with any of these types of deals, what this prospect package ends up looking like down the road. A couple of these guys are raking down in the minors, and that's kind of reassuring for some Cubs fans who are now like clicking refresh on minor league box scores for the first time in a while. But I could see that stance of, oh, man, maybe they should have waited. Maybe the team would be in a better position right now. Things like that. But again, I think at that point in time, they needed, in order to accomplish filling the many holes that were present on the roster, they needed from the front office perspective something to give on the budget. And unfortunately, that was sort of the one fell swoop way to do that and get a package of prospects as the, you know, to use the Jed jargon right now, keep an eye on the future as well as the present. But I also think that move kind of was foreshadowing for where we're at with this team right now and what they're trying to accomplish, where, you know, they are trying to not necessarily go into a full rebuild, but they need to free up some flexibility for the next couple seasons so they can, you know, they have a better foundation in place with some of the young arms they have. And, you know, they're going to have a lot of money potentially coming off the books, and this team, you know, can maybe use this next year or two to kind of get a sense of what the foundation looks like with, you know, Nico Horner, Brennan Davis, potentially reaching the big leagues, you know, some of these arms they have. And then, you know, they still have the wherewithal to be aggressive spenders when the market dictates. So I'm, you know, maybe I'm sipping a little Kool-Aid, but I don't think it could be like a long rebuild like Cubs fans experienced in the past. But it's also, it's hard on Cubs fans right now to see some of these stars they've grown to love and seen grow together to kind of face this reality that some of these dudes will be wearing other uniforms soon.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the idea of a full rebuild and trying to avoid that, because I don't think anybody, even people who aren't Cubs fans, want to see this franchise say, okay, well, check back on us in 5 years.
Right.
You know, like that's not what a Cubs team should be doing. But I'm also sort of struck by the entirety of the situation. And what I mean by that is, yes, everybody wants to know where Chris Bryant will go or where Anthony Rizzo will go. But if you look at the guys who might potentially be available, like they already moved Peterson and they already moved Chafin, and then you have Rizzo and Bryant and Baez and Tapera and maybe Zach Davies. You could even talk yourself into Kyle Hendricks because the starter market is so bad. And it's like, is the best path forward to try to trade like almost everybody and, you know, close your eyes for the next 2 months, I guess? Because it's hard for me to see them actually taking all these big names and moving them all. But I guess there's an argument to actually do that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these guys were signed to such short deals. You mentioned Davies. I don't know if you even mentioned Kimbrel, and that's one of the most attractive pieces on the market. But Jack Peterson, you know, Mariznick, a lot of these guys were signed to these deals, these short-term deals, with the idea that, hey, this is potentially the end of this is like the last go to try and get that ring again. But also, if it doesn't work out, now they're in the other situation of, well, now we have a whole ton of trade chips and you can get some fire prospects. I really like the returns they got for Jock Peterson, who wasn't performing that great. They got an actual kind of fire prospect from the Braves, guy with great power. You know, they flip Chafin and get kind of a raw stuff young low A pitcher. And then they get a good hitter who's close to the big leagues with some good power potential. So you see they're getting like real good value for these short-term contracts. But to your point, I think what needs to be the priority is to figure out which of that core group fits in the picture. You know, if Javi Baez fits in the picture, you know, I think he needs some more clarity along that lines. Or if Chris Bryant fits in the picture, you know, a guy who's been dealing with these trade rumors for 3 straight years and just looked mentally exhausted when we spoke with him after the game the other day. You know, some of these guys need some clarity. Or Rizzo, you know, he turned down an extension. But, you know, I don't think of the core group you can afford to move all of them. But I do think you have to sort of break it up a little bit.
Love your use of the term fire prospects, by the way, there. I think that's a fantastic way to look at it. I forgot to remind everybody, we are, from our point of view, we're recording this on Wednesday morning because everything could change very quickly. We're about 8 hours or so away from first pitch of tonight's Cubs game. But kind of going back to what you just said, of those big names, who is the most likely to still be here in a week?
I think Rizzo could, it seems like the natural one to kind of stay as, you know, maybe on a short-term deal. I think Javi, if you're looking at like a longer-term extension, I think he's the guy that makes the most sense. He's the youngest of the group of the core guys. You know, no one's really talking about Wilson Contreras right now because he has an extra year of control, but I think it'd be really important for them to kind of lock him in. And kind of make him a part of not only this current group, but bridging to the next great Cubs team, again, to use a little Jed Hoyerism. So I think Chris Bryant, you know, just based on everything, you know, we're hearing and reading, he seems, him and Kimbrel seem like the likeliest guys to be moved at the deadline among the big ticket names. I don't think it's unrealistic to see Rizzo moved. I think it's less realistic to see Javi moved. That would be kind of where I would rank them at the moment.
Baez is really interesting to me because he's obviously very popular among the Cubs fan base, and he's said several times he'd like to stay there and be a lifelong Cub. And yet I'm not sure I can think of many players where, I don't know, the way I evaluate him is different than the way I've seen it tossed out there publicly. Like I've seen John Heyman say, well, he might be in line for a $200 million contract if he's a free agent. And I'm like, I just don't know if I see that. Like the last 2 years have been super inconsistent. And even this year, the fielding's been just okay. I mean, is he a guy where if they don't trade him or sign him, he could potentially come back on the qualifying offer? Like that seems like there's some merit to that for both sides.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I don't think that scenario would play out, but I could see him coming back on a deal that maybe, you know, isn't the mammoth deal that people think he could get. But kind of to your point, this dude's a unicorn. Like he's a statistical unicorn. There's no comp for Javi Baez who can get you 30 homers and 100 RBIs while just striking out and not walking all the time. I mean, earlier this year, his strikeout rate was like upwards of 40, close to 50%. His walk rate was like under 4%, and he still was putting up like mammoth power numbers. You know, so he's a really interesting guy defensively. You know, I think some of the advanced stuff has played in his favor in recent years. So I think that can help him because, you know, he's going to bring you plus defense, even if he's going through one of those super cold streaky spells at the plate. But yeah, I just think he's a unicorn and it's going to be really interesting to see what type of offers present themselves to him. I think you could see a wide range or a wide gap in how teams value him just because of the stuff you're mentioning.
Can't talk about Baez without mentioning his walk-off hit against the Reds the other night. And I think a lot of people didn't fully understand that there was a lot of history there with Amir Garrett and the Cubs and all this. What was that like being in the ballpark to see that? You know, I imagine that played out a little differently than it did.
Yeah, he torpedoed my whole story that I had prepared for that day. you know, usually David Ross, when a guy is banged up or out of the lineup with something, Rossi does whatever he can to not use that player. Like, you just know that's a day off for him, you know? And so I had this nice story about Hendricks being one of the guys that's locked up beyond this year and the bridge and the young arms and the foundation. It was great. I had quotes from the pitching coach and, you know, just sort of, I just need nothing crazy to happen in the game, Mike. Just, you know, I can hit send, I can plug the score in and everyone can read about this nice rotation story and how they're building for the future and yada, yada, yada. And then I get my little binoculars out when they call Amir Garrett into the game. And I look down to the dugout and Baez already has a helmet on and he's pacing back and forth like a bull. And I'm like, oh no. Okay. Javi's coming in here. Like, he's not being denied. And I see Rossi's looking down behind him and then he's looking at the field. He's looking back behind him. Javi's pacing. And I'm like, oh, Javi's coming in here. Like he's not telling him he can't. So he goes up there, and I think one of my favorite parts is how he was already like barking at Amir Garrett before he even stepped in the batter's box. And kind of, yeah, for a little bit of background, earlier this year there was an incident where Garrett struck out Rizzo and kind of celebrated a little more than the Cubs would have liked, and Javi leaped over the railing and kind of challenged him. A couple years ago there was another bench clearing where, you know, Javi did the, you know, the hand motion of quit running your mouth, you know, and everyone knows Amir Garrett loves his celebrations and, you know, there's history there. And so you knew it right away. And it was, I mean, that was a blast. It was the first time I actually was happy to have my story just totally rewritten. In the moment, someone tried to talk to me in the press box. I'm like, not now, because I was literally writing what Javi was doing and how he was reacting like in real time. So I could get something in for the website real quick. But there was just chaos below, you know, we were trying to analyze like, what was the maneuver with the bat? Was he rowing a boat? We later figured out like, oh, I think he was, cause in July 4th, Amir Garrett did a sweeping motion. And so I think he was mocking the sweeping motion that Garrett had made last time. But man, it was, that was a wild scene. That was one of the more memorable walk-offs in the last few years for the Cubs. And I mean, and I'll be honest, in a time where there's all these just huge big picture storylines and, you know, the team just got distractions left and right and the actual games haven't really mattered as much as the developments around the team, it was really fun to just have this dynamic moment down on the field between two hyper competitive guys. And the other fun part was Garrett picks up the bat and the umpire, first base umpire ran over and it looked like he was like, "Hey, you remember the visiting dugout? Let me show you right this way, the visiting dugout right this way," and kind of escorted him off the field. And, you know, nothing came of it. So really, really wildly entertaining scene. And, you know, I'll write that rotation story another day.
Last night, they brought Garrett back out to close the game again, and Baez wasn't in the lineup. Did you have your binoculars trained on the dugout, wondering to see if he'd come back out?
Yeah, he actually was getting ready to bat again, and it was, because Patrick Wisdom launched another homer. He's been a great story this year. Bryant hit another homer, great moment for him in the ninth, and then they bring in Garrett, and you're like, here we go again. But Garrett, who said the best revenge would be to shut them down, got his little bit of revenge. So, you know, hey, props to Garrett for not reacting in the moment the other night and turning that into a more chaotic scene than it could have been. You know, I think it ended in a way where, hey, maybe not everyone was pleased, but nobody got hurt. And it was just a really fun bit of entertainment to watch.
Last thing before we let you go, in about 8 hours or so, the Reds and the Cubs will play again, and Davies is scheduled to pitch. Do you, when you go to the ballpark today and you're preparing for today's night's game, do you expect there to be any moves before that game happens, or are we going to see the same Cubs lineup tonight?
I would be surprised at this point if any of the big players are moved before the game. It just feels like one of those things where the names that are left sort of have that deadline day feel to them. So, famous last words, I may be now driving and have four players moved on my way to the ballpark. So, but that's just sort of the sense I get, that we're sort of in down to the wire territory with the names that are left here.
Yeah, I lied. Actually, this is the last question. After this, the Cubs go to Washington for a couple of days where they will be for the deadline. And I assume you're not traveling on that trip. So how are you going to handle the deadline remotely?
We have staff in D.C. I'll be home. We'll be working the phones and getting stories up as quick as possible. And we'll have people on the ground there in D.C. to talk to everybody there. And then once the deadline passes, I will go into a little coma for a couple of days, and then head out to Colorado and deal with whatever the aftermath is. And honestly, it will be fun to get past this. You know me, I love the analytical side of baseball. I'm really looking forward to when I can dive into what Adbert Alzolay is doing with his pitch repertoire. And I think that type of stuff will have a place in August and September, and will be really fun and will be really important for the future direction of this Cubs team. So I think this is all hugely important moments right now for this franchise. Super interesting. But I think, like everyone probably in that clubhouse, I'm also looking forward to, I guess it's July 31st this year, but August 1st.
Big fan of Adbert Alzolay, bigger fan of Jordan Bastian. Jordan, thanks for spending some time with us. Good luck the next couple of days. We will be right back on the MLB.com Ballpark Conventions podcast.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Our thanks to Jordan Bastian for telling us all about the fun at Wrigley. Matt and I usually like to end our show by picking out a guy you should know, and I'm about to shock Matt right now because I had written out something about a guy I wanted to talk about, and I'm going to do a very last-minute change here for, wait for it, a 38-year-old right-handed reliever, Sergio Romo. Yes, that's right. The same Sergio Romo who was a member of those great Giants teams from now like a decade ago. You may not have noticed he was with the Twins last couple of years, and now he's with Oakland, and you might say to yourself, so what? 3.62 ERA, big deal. Why do I care? Here's why you should care. Do you know who the best reliever in baseball was in July? Sergio Romo. In his last 11 games, he has allowed two hits, one walk, 14 strikeouts. He has been phenomenal, and he's changed it a little bit. You know, he's obviously been known for the frisbee slider forever. He used to be more of like a four-seam slider kind of guy, and now he's going with a little more of like a two-seam and changeup and slider, which I think gives him like a bit of a horizontal mirroring effect. He is going to be really interesting if the A's continue to get to the playoffs. So they're, you know, they might win the division. They might get the wild card. I always remembered him as the first opener because he did that for Tampa Bay. And now here he is at 38, still pitching really well, like the best reliever in July, high leverage innings for the A's. And just a brief trade note here. Ken Rosenthal says the Astros are getting another reliever, Yimi Garcia from the Marlins. I feel like we're going to see 650 relievers traded in the next 3 days.
I like the A's and Astros both going to, like, trying to raid the Marlins to decide right. who will win the AL West. Sergio Romo actually closed out the 2012 World Series. I remember that because it was maybe the coldest game I've ever been at.
It was the fastball, right? Like he's known for the slider, and he throws a fastball like right past peak Miguel Cabrera.
Exactly. To finish off the sweep with a hurricane bearing down on us. For my player this week, I'm going to tee him up by mentioning a stat I saw tweeted by our very own Sarah Langs. She tweeted a list the other day. This was entering Sunday. So I'm assuming this probably still holds. Qualified players who are currently 90th percentile or better in both hard hit rate and sprint speed. Shohei Ohtani, okay. Fernando Tatis Jr., all right. Ronald Acuna Jr., great. And number four, the only other player in this category, Tyler O'Neill. Yep, Tyler O'Neill. Let's talk about Tyler O'Neill.
The 0-1 pitch. O'Neill crushes one out to deep left field. How far? Mammoth shot. Tyler O'Neill. Home run number 14. Two-run homer.
Good finish by Tyler O'Neill. Kind of had the Mark McGwire finish on that, didn't he? But not a very violent swing, just a powerful swing.
Tyler O'Neill, as you probably all know, is a Cardinals outfielder from Canada. He was actually originally drafted by the Mariners in 2013, and he was traded to the Cardinals for straight and actually kind of a challenge trade for Marco Gonzalez. He's hitting 274, 331, 526, and his 136 OPS plus is the highest among Cardinals qualifiers. Yes, this is a team that has Nolan Arenado and Paul Goldschmidt, to name a couple of other more famous names. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how the Cardinals over the years have let a lot of talented young outfielders go and that they really could have done a lot more to keep some of these guys. Well, it should be noted that one of the guys they kept and they've held on to, Tyler O'Neill, is actually having a very good season and is a very interesting player. And from like, he also has an interesting bio, as some of you might know. He's an avid weightlifter, and he's been, as per Wikipedia, he's been recorded on video quarter squatting as much as 585 pounds. His father, Terry, was named Mr. Canada in 1975. And you know, I've seen some photos circulating on Twitter of O'Neill's dad. As you can imagine, he is quite, quite jacked.
This is actually kind of a big deal because early in, I guess, last winter, like, I was pretty down on the Cardinals. You know, everybody's like, oh, they won the winter, they got Arenado, and I'm like, I just don't see it. Like, I don't think they're going to be that good. I like the young outfielders they have, Dylan Carlson and Harrison Bader and O'Neill, but I don't like the idea of going into that as that being your guys and not having any veteran outfielders. And that kind of came true. Like, they've had injuries, they've had flashes. Let me give you a number here. In the first half of the season, if you look at the St. Louis outfielders as a group, they had the one, two, three, four, they had the fifth worst offensive performance in baseball, right? Because some of these young guys struggled, and then like Lane Thomas wasn't very good and Justin Williams wasn't very good. Fifth weakest. In the second half of the season, the St. Louis outfielders have been the fourth best. And yes, that's O'Neill, what you said, but also Harrison Bader has been awesome. And he's always been like a fantastic defender, but he has been a really improved batter too. And if this continues, like if we go into the winter and these three younger guys are performing, this might make me think a little bit about how I view about the Cardinals next year. Okay, we are going to finish off our show with a rant. Here's my rant. Sometimes rant are just like served on a silver platter. This is one of those times. You may have seen floating around the internet a video this week where it was supposed that maybe changes in technology were the reason it seems like pitchers are throwing harder. Maybe they're not actually throwing harder. Maybe it's just the technology has changed, the measurement has changed, and I'm here to say no, they're literally just throwing harder. And the point here is not actually about the video that was floating around, but I've heard this argument a lot over the last couple of years, and it usually comes from this people who have an outlook of, well, it's not pitchers that are causing strikeouts, it's hitters who aren't good or care about launch angle. And, you know, back in my day, they would just make contact, as though that's the reason and not that pitchers are great. And listen, here's a thing that is true. StatCast, and before it PitchFX, measures things differently than the old school radar guns did. That's true. StatCast measures out of the hand. PitchFX, which was around from 2008 to 2015, measured it from, like, I want to say 55 feet. Those are all normalized now, right? Everything since 2008 is on the exact same scale. So it's not just that, right? So even if you just look at those on the same scale, in 2008, there were 214 pitches measured at over 100 miles an hour. Through yesterday, this year, halfway through the season, we are over 1,100 of those pitches. Yes, guys are throwing harder. And do you know how we know? Because they keep telling us they're trying to. Guys are actually training for velocity. It used to be you'd get the guy who threw hard and couldn't throw strikes, and maybe you'd teach him to throw strikes. No. Now it's Shane Bieber, the guy with great command who doesn't throw super hard, and you improve your training methods. It is true that radar guns were different back in the day. There's no real database of that. The problem is there were many brands. There were hot guns and cold guns. And sometimes the guy in the stands would point it at the plate. And sometimes he'd point it 10 feet in front of the plate. And sometimes he'd point it at the pitcher's mound. There was no consistency. The final thing I want to say is in the movie Fastball, a claim is made that Nolan Ryan threw the ball 100.8 miles an hour in 1974. Now, our friend Rob Friedman, the pitching ninja, went and did a whole expose on this, because the argument is, because it was tracked near the plate, not out of hand, 100 miles an hour in 1974 should be 108 miles an hour in today's game. I love Nolan Ryan. That dude did not throw 108 miles an hour. As Rob Friedman points out, the device used to track that was never used again because it was unreliable. And if you think that Nolan Ryan threw harder than anybody who lives now, not only the pitchers who lived at the time, well, let Tom Seaver tell you exactly about that.
You talk about you had a Koosman and a Gentry and a Seaver and a Ryan. You got to understand that we all threw hard. We all threw very hard. I mean, I may have gone out there and thrown the ball 98 miles an hour. Koosman may have gone out there and thrown the ball 97 miles an hour. Gentry may have gone out there and thrown the ball 98 miles an hour. Nolan went out there, and he threw the ball 100 miles an hour. And we all knew that he threw it harder than really maybe anybody else we had ever seen. But it wasn't that big a difference relative to the rest of us.
And
he didn't have the control. He was such a raw talent.
So yes, Nolan Ryan threw hard. Of course the top guys did. He did not throw 108. And on aggregate, pitchers from back in the day did not throw harder than they do now. Velocity is up. Pitchers are great. Let's leave it at that.
Here, here. For my rant, I'm going to bring it back to the trade deadline, because at this time of year, you see a lot of conversation about trading prospects, and you hear fans or analysts saying, oh, they can't trade this guy, they can't trade that guy, yada, 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 he's too valuable, you want to get 7 years of team control. Reality, trading prospects is generally fine. The point of the thing when you're trading prospects, you basically have to meet two conditions. One, the player being acquired is actually good and helps you in a meaningful way now. Two, the quality versus quantity is not completely out of whack. Like, it's a relatively even trade. So when people think of the trades that were kind of messed up, they're the ones that failed to meet either or both of these criteria. A very famous recent example is the Chris Archer trade to Pittsburgh at the 2018 deadline, where he went to Pittsburgh and the Pirates sent back Tyler Glasnow, Austin Meadows, and Shane Baz, right? The problem with that trade wasn't that they traded for Chris Archer. The problem was that they weren't real contenders, so he wasn't really helping them in a meaningful way. And they gave up three valuable young players for him. Yes, I know Archer had 2.5 years left on his deal, including a 2020 team option that ended up being declined. but he wasn't even that good in 2020 when the trade was made. Like, the trade was obviously terrible the moment it happened because it was so out of whack for a team that wasn't really a contender at the time anyway. Another notable trade like this was when the Mets infamously traded Scott Kazmir at the 2004 deadline for Victor Zambrano. It wasn't trading Kazmir wasn't what was bad. It was that they weren't really contenders and Zambrano wasn't going to help them get to their goal in any meaningful way. But if you look at more recently at deadline deals of this ilk, look at Aroldis Chapman for Gleyber Torres, Yoenis Cespedes for Michael Fulmer, Zach Greinke of the Astros, Justin Verlander of the Astros, good prospects were given up. But the teams don't regret the trades because they were actually good players who helped the team reach their goals and were actually like specifically helping them in that moment, right? And you even in the offseason, when you look at some of the recent trades where prospects got traded, where the Nats gave up Giolito to get Adam Eaton, who helped them win a World Series, or the Red Sox gave up Yoan Moncada and Michael Kopech to get Sale, who helped them win a World Series. If you're getting good players who are actually improving your team, don't freak out about trading a prospect.
I'm sorry. No, when the Dodgers pulled off one of the greatest trade deadline trades in history in 2008 and got Manny Machado, Manny Ramirez. Yes, they lamented the loss of Andy LaRoche forever. I agree with you. I think everybody gets a little too prospect huggy, and I think part of that is just greater interest in, and access to knowing who these guys are. You know, like 20 years ago, you maybe knew a couple of the names of the top guys in the farm system, and now you can go 45 deep and know their blood type. So,
because the one thing I want to mention too is also, it's like the other thing, it's like a huge, not every major leaguer, but a huge portion of major leaguers, like everyone from like superstars to just like okay major leaguers, were big prospects at one time or another. So it's like a lot of the time, yes, the huge prospects do turn out to be, you know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and he pans out, but a lot of time it's like Andrew Benintendi, and he's just like, okay, he's a guy, you know? So it's like, and more often than not, they're just like a guy, or like even like a slightly above average guy. Like, but it's not like someone who you look back 5 years later and think, oh my goodness, I can't believe we did that.
I am going to hold you to this when we see what happens over the next couple of days, especially when it comes to your favorite team. That is our podcast for this week. Thank you for listening. Don't miss an episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. See you next week.